Let's start off with what's going to be happening in lab, just so I can address both sections simultaneously. We are going to be working on the second experiment in that polypeptide sequence. I think I already gave you a heads up on that. Let me now give you the heads up to go ahead and prepare the third lab in that sequence if and in the event you finish the second lab faster than other people. So we're just going to continue the first, second, third, fourth. Go ahead and prepare those, and you individually just be prepared to work as you finish up. Now, section one, if you didn't quite finish up lab two today, yes, we have a second day to do that on Wednesday. What I'm trying to get across then is don't just show up for 20 minutes just to finish the second portion of that sequence. Be prepared to start the third portion of that sequence as well. Very important topic delineation, meaning I know that amino acids can't be done in one 55-minute test. So some portion of the topics will be thrown off to the final. And as I was telling some people this morning, at least one major topic that would otherwise be on the exam is going to be on the lab quiz instead. So lab quiz number two. We'll have the Merrifield resin synthesis. Which means it'll also have the diterp butyl dicarbonate. And DCC. So those mechanisms and all of the discussions of why do we even need some kind of protecting group or this resin synthesis. All these aspects will be on the lab quiz alone. They are lecture topics, yes. But we did actually learn them in lab, and it's related to the dipeptide synthesis. Now, there may be a lab lecture on exactly the form of dipeptide synthesis that you're doing where we can discuss the differences between it and this Merrifield synthesis, but that does give us some time to do that before we actually get to the lab quiz. As far as what else is going to be on exam three, well, it's going to be everything else related to amino acids that we've covered. So let me just walk through the chapter. I know this is Monday. This would be more appropriate on Wednesday, but why not give you more advance warning of the types of things I'm going to be looking for in the exam, right? That also gives me a chance to walk through the chapter and find exactly which small details that we haven't covered yet. The lab quiz is the Monday, the last day of school, so the week of finals, which if this is the 10th week, that means it's 2 weeks from today. Correct? That those items that are listed above the line would be on the lab quiz. Then, for exam three, we need to know your different amino acids, of which at least 8 or 10 of them I'm hoping that you've memorized by now. If we don't happen to see the structures of others before the exam, well, maybe you won't need to know those. Of course, we always have Wednesday's lecture left, don't we? So hopefully you've been working on memorizing your amino acids. We have D versus L amino acids, which is a simple thing to determine, but you still need to know what it is. Then there's the PI and acid-base properties of amino acids. So being able to construct the different types of graphs that we've seen so far, as far as the, for example, displaying how much of the cationic, anionic, or zwitterionic forms of amino acid we might have, be potentially able to extend that graft to handle the situations of things like aspartic acid that have a second carboxylic acid group, or lysine that has a second amino group. That led us straight into electrophoresis, which is where we could take advantage of the different acid-base properties of amino acids. And so, for example, if I gave you the PI of two different amino acids and I told you what pH you were carrying out an electrophoresis experiment under, you should be able to determine, oh, one is going to be more in its cationic form, one's going to be more in its anionic form, and on the basis of charge, they're therefore going to separate. It's exactly the type of scenario we just talked about in lecture. That is going to come back. Right after that, we did talk about ion exchange chromatography. In connection with which, actually, this went for both of these topics, ninhydrin. So don't forget that structure or what the derivative of it forms. I'm going to warn you now, on Wednesday, after I consider these topics, I might consider moving one more topic to the lab quiz to reduce the burden on the exam. And I'm thinking one of the most likely things I would ask on the lab quiz or topics I would move would be either the ion exchange or electrophoresis aspect. I'm not sure. Probably even more the ion exchange column. Seems like a good way to fill out that lab quiz. So, now where we were at on lecture the other day, and we'll finish up today, is the synthesis of amino acids. We've gotten one major synthetic route, that's the thiamidyl malonic ester synthesis. We also need to cover the Strecker synthesis, and we'll come back and finish that afterwards. One of the other things that we'll finish up today is on protein structure. We'll discuss what is primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary protein structure. As I'm flipping through, I now see the section on Merrifield resin, which I already listed that. We have the DCC that I already listed. Sequencing. We've seen the Edman degradation. And methionine is another amino acid that we can cleave. But we haven't discussed that route yet. So one other detail to fill in. Secondary structure, tertiary structure, quaternary structure. That's the end of the chapter. So there's all our major topics. Question about the topics before I go back and fill in the holes. Yes? The acid and base, where that would show up would be in a discussion of the PI point. So I might ask, what is the PI? How could the PI be calculated? How could the PI be experimentally determined? That experimentally determined part goes back to titration and the special situation of the half equivalence point being where the pH would be equal to the pKa. As long as we're able to make certain simplifications based on the strength of the acid and the concentrations of solutions. Yes? If I have a question where you need quantitative information, I will give it to you. You are not expected to memorize any pKa values for amino acids. Any other review type questions? Because I'm going to fill in the holes, but any of these topics we've covered already. Does anybody need or want any clarification on anything? You got Wednesday to have a chance to ask as well. I figure before I wrap it up here. Yes?
Do you need to know buffers?
No. I'm not going to ask a Chem 1A or B style question of here's a buffer system with a pH and here's how much you have material wise to make it. How would you do it? No. But that is what I'm hoping you would be able to do with a little more review based on the review we did of acid-based chemistry.
That's just for your benefit, not going to show up on the exam.
Well, let's fill in these holes. Let me flip back here. Just go through one more time. Let's pick up a couple more of these amino acids. Since we're going to get to methionine later, I might as well show you methionine. Methionine is another sulfur-containing amino acid. And to make this a bit simpler, I'm going to switch to putting the amino group in the dash wedge position, which, remember, for L amino acids that are written, turns out by convention, where the carbonyl is written to the right, but also not just based on convention, putting the carbonyl pointing up like I've got it here. Let me write it in its Zwitter ionic form, which I myself should get used to because it makes things simpler in discussing. Virtually all of the amino acids, let me look so I can change that to saying all. It is all. All amino acids have at least this methyl group here, other than the simplest amino acid of glycine. And then we have another methyl, a sulfur, and another methyl to get us methionine. What's another nice one? Oh, well, if we got phenylalanine, tyrosine, which kind of remember your textbook talked about how that's related to cheese, tyros being Greek for cheese, I think. If we take phenyl... Move it up, of course I can. If we take phenylalanine, which... If you don't remember that, alanine is the simplest amino acid that has, alanine is the simplest amino acid that has a stereocenter, so it has just a methyl group on it. Phenylalanine means add a benzene ring to that, and then tyrosine, you just add a hydroxy group to the benzene. So that's L-tyrosine. Let's do a popular one. And to do that first, let me show you the heterocycle indole. So if we take... alanine and stick it onto not the position next to the nitrogen, but one more position over, that gets us tryptophan. Which, does anybody know any stories about tryptophan that you can tell while I'm writing the structure out? It's supposedly the chemical in turkey that makes you sleepy, although supposedly to get enough of it where it actually make you sleepy, you'd have to have, I don't know how many dozens of turkeys to get that quantity. What else is tryptophan related to? If you were to functionalize tryptophan a bit, what molecule do you end up with? Isn't it also related to serotonin, which is one of the major neurochemicals, one of the major neurochemical systems in the body? If we get the time, we'll come back to neurotransmitters at the end of the quarter. Three new amino acids, that's good enough. The tryptophan, it does help if you separately memorize the structure indole first, and then remember the attachment point, which every year that ends up being confusing, even for me. But as I'm writing these down, I'm making mental pictures because I'm going to memorize these. And then we have those other amino acids, which let's see if I can do this again. We have glycine, alanine, valine, leucine. We have cysteine for our oxygen-containing group. Serine for our oxygen-containing group. Cysteine for our sulfur-containing one. Phenylalanine for our benzene one. Proline for our heterocycle. aspartic acid for our carboxylic acid, and then lysine for our amino group, plus these. So we're starting to get complete. Let's move on. We did D and L. We did PI point. We did electrophoresis. We did anhydrin. Synthesis of amino acids. So we did the thalamidomalonic ester synthesis already. Let's now see the Strecker synthesis. Which is where you can start out with an aldehyde and then form an imine. Notice that we use only ammonia because the amino groups, except if you wanted to think of it that way, proline, they don't have any attachments on the nitrogen. Turns out if we take quite a potent combination, sodium cyanide and hydrochloric acid, does anybody realize why I say this is a potent combination? A lethal combination. The cyanide ion itself is not necessarily directly toxic, but hydrogen cyanide, the gas, is immediately toxic. So we'd be very, very, very careful with this. This is going to end up being addition across a bond whose name I should know the name of, but the equivalent of a carbonyl. If this was back in Chem 12B and you saw this reagent, sodium cyanide, you'd think, oh, we're making a cyanohydrin. We're doing the same style reaction, it's just we happen to have an imine instead. So push that open. You're going to end up with the amino group, plus then we have a nitrile. Notice that is going to be protonated if we truly are under acidic conditions. We'll keep those acidic conditions, turn up the heat, literally, and hydrolyze. Well, we already learned that if we hydrolyze a nitrile, we're going to end up with a carboxylic acid. Notice that we're effectively adding one carbon, and it's going to end up making that nitrogen that was part of the imine a nitrogen that's at the alpha position. So in other words, we turn it into an amino acid. Like the thalamidomalonic ester synthesis, I don't have control over stereochemistry. So notice I am showing this product with just a plain line. And we may talk about an antimeric resolution today. So there's your second synthetic route. Again, making an imine first, doing the equivalent of making a cyanohydrin, and then hydrolyzing the nitrile that results. Yes?
Question about the methionine.
Yes?
Do you need one more carbon for
S? Did I leave? Oh, I did leave a carbon out. I said it out loud and I didn't write it. So please, yes. All those of you had already memorized it, how come you didn't tell me I was wrong? You don't believe everything your instructors say, do you? You don't believe anything your instructors say, do you? There we go. You're still traumatized from this morning. I'm sorry. Now, there's one more reaction, but I'm going to have to come back and pick this up on Wednesday because the reaction it depends on. We never did cover when we did carboxylic acid chemistry. That would be the Helvohart-Zelinski reaction, the HVZ reaction. So we'll pick that up Wednesday. Now let's just, let me just give you a brief introduction to an antimeric resolution.
So the problem with enantiomers and separating them is that they are identical to each other except for this issue of optical rotations. They have the same boiling point, melting point, freezing point, index of refraction, all the other things that you might try to pull tricks with in order to separate these compounds out. So you don't try. You find, or one approach is to take a chiral auxiliary, a separate molecule that you react with the one that you're trying to isolate. For example, if we had an amino acid that we were somehow able to attach to some other chiral molecule, and I'm going to keep that so that we can do the short version today, let's keep the identities of these molecules generalized. I'm going to put a star here because I know I never use this notation, but technically, stars are often used in discussion of mechanism to show that you have a stereocenter. Let's say we have some other molecule that we're going to be able to react with the amino acid, but maybe not react, maybe make some kind of salt out of it. Let's say that, well, we don't have to say, the amino acid only has one stereocenter to it, correct? Let's say that the chiral auxiliary also has only one stereocenter to it. So if both these molecules had the potential just to be enantiomers beforehand, if somehow we make a complex well, then even if we were to use just the R version of the chiral auxiliary, but if the amino acid could be R or S, well, that means we're going to end up with diastereomers, not enantiomers. Let me, instead of putting it all in the picture form, let me put some text to this. And let's say we had these situations. Here's the amino acid, here's the auxiliary. When we do the synthesis, we actually end up with two amino acids. And let's say that one's in its R form and one's in its S form. Let's say that we use the auxiliary only in its R form. So when we make the complex, one of them is going to be RR, one of them is going to be SR, the way that I've drawn that out. The amino acids couldn't be separated because they're enantiomers, which means all their physical properties are identical. Once we made a complex that's diastereomeric, diastereomers have different physical properties, which means one of them will be able to take advantage of in order to separate the two complexes out. If this was a salt formation, for example, something very easily reversible, then after we separate the complexes, we decompose them again. And we get back to the amino acid. So, since amino acids are enantiomers, they cannot be easily separated. Since their physical properties are identical, except optical rotation, which cannot be used to separate the compounds. If the amino acid forms a complex with some other compound that has one stereocenter, let me specify. If a mixture of enantiomeric amino acids this mixture is reacted with some other compound that has a stereocenter. So if this happens, diastereomers are produced. Since diastereomers have different physical properties, they can be separated. If the amino acid can then be re-separated from the molecule it reacted with, the amino acid has been effectively, the enantiomers have effectively been separated. Now, this is the old school step-by-step approach. Your textbook does mention the fact that there's a host of biological molecules that are designed to do exactly this type of thing. Enzymes, in other words. So we could actually take advantage and use biological sources, enzymes, to cause some of these types of separations. Now, not being a chemical engineer or production chemist, I don't know how that's accomplished on the large scale. But fact remains, you can use biological sources in order to separate molecules out. Oh, okay. Questions?
Well, don't you think they would put like yeast, and then like yeast can? Well, I guess that'd be like.
Presumably, yeah. There is a host of chiral tricks, which I'll admit this right now. I never took biochem because it wasn't a requirement for my major. So I would love to go take it one day if someone knows the bestest instructor anywhere to go take it from.
I don't know. That's hard.
Okay, well, if someone has recommendations, someone local like either Santa Cruz, Stanford, San Jose State, you know, one of... Oh, okay. I need to learn it one day. Questions? Let's move on, filling up the hole. Oh, yes, let's do protein structure now. So there's four forms of structure that are talked about in your text. Primary, we've already done. That is the sequence, which is the order of amino acids. What's that?
mean, why don't I just say AA everywhere? Because every time I use an abbreviation, I always end up with someone that says, what's the abbreviation mean? So now I'm erring the side of the fewer number of people that ask, why aren't you using the abbreviations? You know, damned if I do, damned if I don't. So, now, skipping along here. Primary, well, no, before we get to secondary structure, we need to talk about methionine. So let me draw this out. Give me a moment to do so. So let's say that we're in the middle of a peptide chain, and here's a methionine unit, which is this time drawn correctly because I do have two carbons. Or did I put one more carbon in now? This one, two, that is one too many carbons now because I wrote the extra widget. I can't imagine a world without it, you know. So this methionine can be decomposed by this molecule, bromine attached directly to what looks like a cyano group, and this is called cyanogen bromide. Turns out that it can react with the sulfur in methionine. And so you have a kind of, well, it's not kind of, it really is, this portion, an SN2 reaction. Sulfur becoming positively charged in this way is not nearly as unusual as oxygen becoming positively charged. We didn't do it, but we might before the quarter's up. There's one other reaction, the Swern oxidation, that also involves a sulfur being alkylated like this. Yes? I need one more carbon. No, this is supposed to be just... One, two. One, two.
The near the sulfur.
There's this carbon, there's that carbon.
No, the other way.
There's supposed to be two carbons other than the point where it's attached. I see two carbons there.
The other way of the sulfur, the right hand side of the sulfur.
I'll say it again. Here's the chain. Here's one, two carbons. There's where sulfur's attached. Here's the methyl group on the end of the sulfur. That's the same thing as I've got on left here. One, two, then sulfur, then the methyl group left to sulfur. So this is correct this time. I did put one too many earlier in the lecture, but I can learn from my mistakes. So unless I'm doing something else really wrong, this is now correct. So now there's a cascade reaction that you can't tell because the way I drew the molecule. Now I can see why the textbook is drawing it this way. Because this sulfur group ends up being a leaving group. And remember that nitrogen strongly is conjugated, conjugated with its carbonyl neighbor. So it turns out that that carbonyl can be forced to open and kick that sulfur leaving group off. Gesundheit.
We don't have.
Good one.
No, you don't. And I'm going to drop stereochemistry because it doesn't particularly matter. So there's one, two, three, four, five. Good. I made a five-membered ring because that's what we should have. Because one, two, three, four. Yes. No, that's correct. Okay. So if you hydrolyze this, though, you have effectively an imine trapped in the same thing that looks like a part of an ester. So this will hydrolyze. Notice that it's got the rest of the amino acid chain that's going to go away. Let me see if I actually am going to want you to know the rest of the derivatives that are formed. At least what comes right after this. So amine degradation, we learned previously, allows us to pull one amino acid off at a time. This is a technique that's used to chop up amino acid chain just at this one methionine group. It just happens to work. Now we can move on to secondary structure. So Tyler, you were about to make some comment about secondary structure. What's that? Okay, those are the three main things mentioned in your textbook as well. Let me show you, and give me a moment to try to write this out again clearly. We're going to do this without stereochemistry again. Ooh, I'm doing the chain backwards, but that's okay. A title? Let me draw it up and I'll put a title on for you. How's that? So what I'm trying to show is what you can get when you have two different amino acid chains that line up with each other. You can get quite a bit of
hydrogen bonding in between two strains. Imagine this, if you were to allow those amino acid chains to start to form some kind of twist, that maybe within that twist, you'd also get these inter-chain interactions as well. And so on the basis of these kinds of intramolecular hydrogen bonding, that we formed the different kinds of structures that Tyler was referring to a minute ago. So one type of structure is an alpha helix, which right, it's, I'm trying to remember which way it is. It is clockwise for L amino acids. Which means from the bottom, or from the top as you go down, if you're looking from one down, looking from above, that is, then it's going to appear to be clockwise as you go further and further, further down the helix. There are beta pleated sheets. And I'm not going to attempt to draw this. I'll say look at page 1013 in your text. The alpha helices are on page 1012. But essentially what this is you have these two chains of amino acids that are kind of crinkling back and forth as you go from one amino acid to the next, to the next, to the next. That's where this pleated term comes from for the sheets. Then, again, not trying to draw a picture of it for you, there are various forms of coils that can form. The difference between those and an alpha helix is a very predictable pattern that's got a fairly fixed distance between the different coils. Between the different loops of the helix, the coil could be a larger structure, maybe less well-defined in structure. Beta pleats, again, tend to be more regular. There's a good picture on the bottom of page 1013 that shows a combination of these different structural features. Yes?
The alpha helix and the beta pleated sheets, is it just one long amino acid chain or is that multiple?
The alpha helix is going to be one chain that wraps along itself. The beta pleated sheet is going to be one chain that kind of comes around and wraps. Depending, because you can have chains that go back and forth like this, or you might have something wrap around and come back a second time and be part of the sheet.
But
so sometimes
it's one long amino acid chain.
Generally, yes. Yes. Now, there are ways that these complexes can come together, but that's usually under quaternary structure. So this is secondary structure, which is based on hydrogen bonding interactions. So now to put your title. Features of a protein caused by hydrogen bonding interactions. Then there's tertiary structure, which is the minimization of energy. And this is not due just to hydrogen bonding, but hydrophobic, hydrophilic interactions in solution. So think about all these different amino acids that we have with all the different R groups. Some of the R groups that are more likely to be ionized, something like aspartic acid, might be more likely to turn so that its R group is facing a water phase. If you have something like phenylalanine, which is quite clearly nonpolar in its R group, would be much more likely to be pointed to something that's not aqueous. In other words, if you have fat molecules floating around, they'd want to turn to that direction. If all these proteins are floating around in cells and other structures in the body, often where you have interfaces between an aqueous phase, the bloodstream, for example, or a non-aqueous phase, fat lightings, for example. Well, then exactly which sequence of R groups that you have in amino acid is going to cause it to fold up in such a way so that as an entire structure, that protein is able to orient as many of those hydrophilic groups towards the water phase that it can, and as many as those hydrophobic groups away from water. Other terminology that's often used is lipophilic, which means fat-loving, which would be hydrophobic, or lipophobic, which would be fat-fearing, which would be hydrophilic. That's what happens in tertiary structure. A protein attempts to adopt a lowest energy structure. Aside from hydrogen bonding, the conformation of a protein is caused by hydrophobic, hydrophilic, or lipophilic, lipophobic interactions of the amino acid side chains with their surrounding environment. It is largely because of this tertiary structure that proteins have whatever function that they do. Because the various alpha helices and beta sheets, those might be features buried within this larger structure. But having all the complex folds that occur in a protein is going to be more due to what happens once it gets into solution. Destroy that order, and that's to remove its special functionality, which would be to denature a protein. So, for example, when we cook things, we're denaturing because we're unraveling this tertiary structure. The secondary structure, because it involves more localized interactions, might be tougher to break. And, of course, primary structure requires stomach acid, hydrolyzing all those amide bonds. So, in fact, it's the very, very, very last thing that's in this chapter. Yep, it mentions it. Denaturing is destroying the tertiary structure of a protein. It will just take me a minute to wrap up quaternary structure, which is macromolecular structure, which would be the assembly of large protein units into a complex. And just because we're out of time, I'll let you read up about hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is a molecule that has four protein units, each one of which has an iron center. It's the iron center at which oxygen, carbon dioxide exchange occurs. And it's four of these things that are not necessarily bound to each other. Again, just extensive interactions with each other. They hold four of these protein units into one structure of hemoglobin. Wednesday, I'll have just a couple more comments, but we're effectively done with this chapter. This is the only chapter that's going to be on the exam, but if we have time, then we're going to switch over to chapter 27.
which is on lipids and other fat-soluble molecules.